So this time we're going to do something fun. I hope you were all satisfied with the problem class yesterday.
Well, there were some classification that wanted to make this afternoon.
What's that?
There were some clarification I want to make this afternoon.
This afternoon?
Yeah. Like,
okay.
I'll write it up and clarify. But they are still not satisfied, and we work on trying to satisfy them.
Very good. Very good. So, yeah, what time? You have a class this afternoon?
Oh, no, we don't.
Oh, okay.
But they'll get an email from me.
All right, fine. I hope you work through the second part of that question to go to locally inertial coordinates. Do you work through that? Did that clarify or not? I mean, the point is very fundamental because it's the equivalence principle. It's saying that if I am that, as we described, at every point in space-time, it is possible to go to coordinates such that the metric is Minkowski, plus corrections up to the square of the distance from the point concerned, right? And so by changing to those coordinates, you know that if you measure the separation of the two particles using a non-gravitational means, using, you know, an electromagnetic ruler, a laser or something like that, that this is the distance you will measure. So you go to those coordinates and describe the distance in terms of the local flat space-time coordinates. That is the distance you will measure with non-gravitational means. So,
But you're going to measure a different distance with non-gravitational basis with gravitational one?
No. With non-gravitational means. Okay, so at any space-time point, you can choose coordinates where g mu nu is equal to eta mu nu plus distance square corrections. Right, we showed that. So at every space-time point, I can pick coordinates in which space-time is flat. The statement is that physics, in the presence of GR, is simply exactly what it is in flat space, which we know, special relativity, atomic physics, and all of that, and up to these corrections. Okay. So if you change, so a gravitational wave goes past, you change coordinates to one in which space-time is locally flat, you measure the distance between those two points using non-gravitational means. That just means using some standard lab apparatus, right? Equals ruler, laser, etc. You will measure the distance as measured in this coordinate system. That's the meaning of the equivalence principle.
Yeah, what if you use gravitational means, you're going
to measure... No. The whole point of the equivalence principle is that space-time is a curved structure. Locally, it's flat. If you say, what are the laws of physics in a curved space-time? They're exactly what they have to be so that you can ignore the curvature up to order distance squared. Okay, so you know how to measure distances if you ignore gravity, right? In special relativity, you know how to measure distances.
So you
that's what you
don't
do.
Don't know how to do it with gravity, so you want.
With gravity, it's inherently non-local. I mean, it's the distances involve, you know, generally involve curved geodesics, et cetera, et cetera. And
so you just want to use non-gravitational waves. It's not that you have to.
Well, that's what you mean by the length of an object. Physically, the length of this piece of chalk, I don't include gravity when I...
Why not?
Because
that's
the meaning...
Are you just going to choose a geodesic and integrate over the geodesic?
No, that length of chalk has nothing to do with geodesics. These particles are bound together by atomic forces that do not include gravity.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Photons do travel.
Pardon?
I mean, in your non-gravitational means, you include lasers?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything that doesn't involve gravity.
Okay, but are photons going to follow, like...
They are, but if you measure the wavelength, you're measuring the wavelength of a photon with a non-gravitational device, aren't you? I mean, how do you measure? You measure the spectrum of light, you have a spectrometer, that doesn't involve gravity.
Sure.
The whole point of GR is that you take special relativity, all the laws of particle physics, electromagnetism, etc., and you say those are all valid, okay? And gravity doesn't affect them, except that I change eta mu nu to g mu nu. That's the only change I make. Now, there's some small amendments to this, but this is the philosophy. The amendments are that I can add quantities that do correct the laws up to order distance squared. But the philosophy is that I take special relativity, that's how I define lengths, that's how I define local physics, and I just replace the metric with g. So all the devices experimentalists use involve definitions which do not take gravity into account. Okay? So that process of going to local inertial locally flat coordinates is very fundamental to the coupling of gravity to other devices. And that's what is done in that problem. Mm-hmm.
Can you clarify that the pulse don't have to end it at the same point, like they could be a heavy setting function? That's where, why we...
Oh, you mean the gravitational wave pulse?
Yeah, the memory effect. Like if it's a pulse come at T0 and then later T return to itself, then there is no memory. So
I think you're saying HIJ, it's a function of T minus X or X minus T or something like that.
Yeah.
And you're saying that as viewed as a function of X, it HIJ doesn't have to return to the same value, right? So HIJ could be a sine wave, which averages to zero, or it can be this function. It can be any function.
But can it have complex support?
Can it have?
Can we have it?
Doesn't have to have compact support. No need. The equation it's satisfied is dt squared minus dx squared h equals 0. And that's it. Any function of x plus t or x minus t satisfies that equation. Doesn't have to have compact support. What?
It's h, right? It's
h.
Small. I think that's his point.
This is small. This can be 10 to the minus 4. That's small. Everything is still valid. No need for H to return to 0. Just do some examples. I mean, in fact, I recently gave a seminar about this. A beautiful example of such a thing. In electromagnetism, there's the same effect, memory effect. And that is to do with the vector potential, right? I don't want to get too into this because I'm very enthusiastic about it. and I want to teach you about black holes. But let me say briefly. If you look up in Jackson, the effect, you know, what happens if a particle moves? Let's say I've got some medium in which the speed of light is a bit slower than c, right? This is very common. And a particle goes through that medium, like water. The particle goes through water at c. What happens? Particle goes through a medium faster than the speed of light in the medium. Cherenkov radiation. Okay, so Cherenkov is a really beautiful example. And the exact solution to the Maxwell equation looks like this. The particle is going faster than the speed of light. So necessarily, A mu is 0. Outside this cone, right, by causality. This cone, I've drawn it badly. It should be at 45 degrees, I guess, if this is, let's say, x and y. So the cone is like No, sorry, I'm wrong. It doesn't have to be at 45 degrees. The point is that this has to be moving at the local velocity of light, c bar, let's say, and the particle is moving at c, the speed of light, and this is the angle. So we have whatever, sine theta equals c bar over c, less than 1. Okay, that's Cherenkov radiation. Now you ask yourself, what is the solution inside the cone? Must be a solution of the Maxwell's equation. The nice thing that happens, and this is not in Jackson's book, is if I don't take a point particle here, but I take a line of charge, right? So you can get this by the superposition principle. Just take a line of charge, and this is moving faster than light. And you ask, what's the solution inside here for the line? So now I have a wedge behind the line, okay? And then the exact solution is that phi is phi naught and a is a naught, some particular vector potential and constant, by the way, inside the wedge. So you know the thing, when I take a charge and I move it fast, its electric field gets squeezed into a pancake in electromagnetism, right? So you'll find this in Purcell's book. There are beautiful pictures of it. So now what it says is, well, you can go faster than light. Basically, the electric field and the magnetic field, the electric field coming out of this charged line gets completely squeezed into a sheet. Okay, there's no electric field here, no electric field here, no electric field here. All of it is in the sheet. And there's actually a magnetic field also in the sheet. And this guy is, of course, a delta function plane wave of electromagnetism. But it's a delta function. Just the E and B are at one, are in the surface. And the vector potential is a constant behind the wave. That's the memory effect. Okay, so this is an example in electromagnetism of how to get a memory effect. And in gravitational waves, exactly the same. So in fact, we're just writing a paper now on gravitational Cherenkov radiation from those shocks I showed you. Showed you a movie of shocks. Turns out if two shocks collide, intersect at an acute angle, they emit gravitational waves, and there's a memory effect. So absolutely nothing wrong with H that doesn't return. What Christodoulou showed, so this was kind of known about for a long time, but then what Christodoulou proved rigorously, Christodoulou, okay, so he's a sort of world expert on proving things rigorously about fluid solutions of fluid equations, and GR equations are very similar. So what he showed is that the magnitude of this memory effect, the jump in H, is determined by a nonlinear property of the source which emits the wave. And in general, there's a non-zero memory effect from any source emitting gravitational waves. That's due to the nonlinearity of GR. In electromagnetism, the way to get it is to have a source that goes faster than the speed of light. But it's only a linear theory, and so that's why you have to sort of play around a little bit. In GR, generically, this is true. When these two black holes merge, you see one way to see that there should be such effect is the long-range field of the two black holes. You know that's going to be, actually, we're about to do it. 2gm over r c squared will be the h. That's the metric perturbation introduced by a mass. That's the Schwarzschild metric. And you know if the mass is going to change a little bit, that coefficient of the 1 over r has to change. And that coefficient is the memory effect. The change in that coefficient is the memory effect. So in spherical symmetry, it doesn't go to constant. It actually goes like 1 over r because the whole thing is spherical. And you know, in 1D, the solution of this equation would be constant. But in 3D, it has to go like 1 over r. 2D, it would be log r. And the coefficient changes. And that's the memory effect. OK, so let's do the Schwarzschild metric now. And actually, we're going to do a little bit more than the Schwarzschild metric. We will prove the Birkhoff theorem, which is a very, very powerful result, which says that if you have spherical symmetry in general relativity, any situation of spherical symmetry, the vacuum equations, the empty space Einstein equations, imply a unique metric called the Schwarzschild metric, which has only one free parameter, which is basically the mass, which is inside this empty region, in the mass in the interior of this vacuum region. So this is the situation we're typically interested in. We have some object there, which is localized, and we're going to solve the empty space Einstein equations, assuming. So we're going to solve these assuming only spherical symmetry. Okay, of course that's a big assumption, but
only spherical symmetry, not staticity.
Sorry?
Not a static.
Not static. Assuming only spherical symmetry. We're not going to assume it's static. So we're going to allow this mass to vibrate or to explode. The mass can do whatever it likes. As long as it's spherically symmetric, it will satisfy the theorem. And so that's kind of why this Birkhoff theorem is so surprising, that the mass can do whatever it likes as long as it's spherically symmetric. The exterior metric is unique. So of course, for Christodoulou to get an effect, he has to do something non-spherical. OK, so let us try to write down the most general metric consistent with spherical symmetry. Well, we have to make this metric out of quantities. We must make it from quantities which are invariant under rotations. Okay, so it makes sense to imagine that the time-like coordinate, so there exists a time-like coordinate, t, which is invariant. So we can build our metric out of t. And then there exist three space-like coordinates, coords, x. And by definition, we will say that these transform like x prime equals ox. OK, they transform under rotations just as the components of a three-dimensional vector. So that's what we mean by having the action of rotations on our metric. We mean that there should be some coordinates which transform linearly under the rotation group. And now we just write down all the invariants. So the invariants are t, and then dt, of course. The R squared, which is x squared. Of course, that's invariant under rotation. We have R dr, which is invariant, which of course is x dot dx. O here is viewed as a constant matrix. It's just a rotation matrix, right? So you have dx prime also transforms as O. And then, of course, we have dx squared. And it's useful to change coordinates from x, Cartesian coordinates. Think of these as Cartesian coordinates. It's useful to change from these to spherical polars because we're doing spherical symmetry. And so dx squared is just dr squared plus r squared sine squared theta. Plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so here what I'm doing is I'm writing x, the coordinate x, this vector x is of course r sine theta cos phi, sine theta sine phi, I guess. Which way do we usually do it? I guess we put a cosine there. Cos phi, sine phi, cos theta. This is the transformation from Cartesian to spherical polars. And if you work out the dx squared, you just get the line element or the metric on a sphere with these coefficients. And we're going to, because this angular term is always the same, we will write that as dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. So d omega squared is the metric on a two-sphere of unit radius. Okay, so line element on S2 of unit radius. Okay, so that's the rule. We can write down anything which is built out of these invariants, and the most general metric is minus a function of r and t, arbitrary function of r and t, dt squared plus another function of r and t, the r squared minus another function of r and t, the r dt plus another function of r and t, r squared d omega squared. Okay, so this is just saying that I'm using all these invariants. I can use dt squared, I can use dr squared, I can use d omega squared, and I can use dr dt, and all of them have to have, can have arbitrary functions of these invariant quantities multiplying them. So that is the most general metric you can write down, which is spherically symmetric. Now let's simplify this by defining r prime to equal square root of f of r and t times r. Okay, so I just define this guy to be r prime squared. And that's my new coordinate radius. The reason that's a good idea is it means that in these coordinates, the area of a sphere of of a two-sphere of radius r prime is just 4 pi r prime squared, just as you would do in flat space. Why? Because that sphere, so when I say area of a two-sphere of radius r prime, I need to tell you what the other coordinates were. Well, if r prime is fixed, then the dr prime will be 0. And I also need to tell you that dt is 0. So I need to tell you that if I take a fixed time slice at some fixed time, t is a constant, so dt is 0. You can drop this. If r is fixed, you can drop these two terms. And so then the area is calculated just using this metric. Well, that's the flat space metric for a sphere. Well, the combination is exactly the metric on the sphere of radius r prime. So the area will be, so the area of a two surface of fixed t and r prime will be 4 pi r prime squared. Okay, so that's sort of a sensible coordinate system. You know exactly what the area of a sphere of fixed r prime is. So we're going to change to this being r prime squared. Of course, I need to change all these functions because so dr needs to, I need to invert this to find r in terms of r prime, and I need to express dr as dr dr prime dr prime and solve for all these. It doesn't really change anything because these were completely general functions. I'm just going to get some other functions. And so then we will drop the primes. Okay, so I'm going to do this repeatedly. We'll change coordinates, and then we'll drop the primes because we don't want to bother writing the primes. So now my metric is minus c of r and t dt squared. This is a different c, right, because I had to change dr prime and substitute back. But in any case, it was completely general. Dr squared minus 2d of r and t dr dt plus r squared d omega squared. OK, so I've just removed one of the free functions without losing any generality. OK, now this is still pretty ugly because it has this cross term. So let us remove the top. So now we will remove the cross term. It makes us cross. And groan. you guys have no sense of humor. Or nor do I, actually. OK. dt prime. So how do we remove this cross term? Any ideas? How am I going to get rid of that, that term? I can obviously. What I'd like to do is go from r and t to r prime and t prime, which are functions of r and t. And I want to do it in such a way as to get rid of that guy. OK? So any ideas?
Combine them both, like find a coordinate that depends maybe linearly.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Some principal function of r and t.
Well, OK, so for sure, I must have an equation that the dt prime should be linear in terms of dr and dt. So let's just write that down. Let's see. Yeah, let me write something down. And then argue why this works. OK, so I'm going to claim that if I define my new time coordinate like this, I will miraculously remove this term. OK, why is that the case? Because you see dt prime squared is f squared. Let me not bother with the arguments. Is so this guy's going to give me c squared dt squared Then I'm going to get a cross term of 2cd dr dt. And then I'm going to get plus d squared dr squared. OK, just squaring that equation. And now this looks very good, because you see the coefficient of the dt squared and the dr dt involves a factor of c, which I can pull out, and then 1c here and a 2d there. So I have exactly the combination that I want to fit these two terms. OK? So then this equals minus dt prime squared. So I need to pull out that factor of c and divide by c squared f, by c f squared, c f squared. OK? That will give me this bracket with 1c gone. OK, so what I'm doing is I'm removing that c. This becomes like this. This becomes over c. And then dividing by cf squared. So I get exactly this term and that term from here and there. Now I've got one other term which I'll have to remove, but that's not hard to do. So what I do is just add it on to the dr squared. D squared over c plus e, times dr squared plus r squared, d omega squared. OK, so the cross term has disappeared. Now, of course, you still, so the cross term has disappeared. Now, of course, you still have to prove that there exists a function t prime such that this is true. Okay, but we must show there exists a function t prime of r and t, or t and r, such that star is true. Star is this guy. So how do we do that? Well, you see star implies that the partial derivative dt prime dt, by definition, the partial derivative means differentiate at fixed values of all the other coordinates, right? So I differentiate with respect to t and I fix r. And so this term goes away. So dt prime dt is fc, right? And likewise, dt prime dr is fd. So can I fall into function c, t prime, such that these two equations are valid? Now, I've left this f deliberately as an arbitrary function. F is completely undetermined function at this point. F can be anything, right? And this is still true. So it's very, very useful to have that, because the F will, so can we solve this? So does a solution exist? And I can adjust this F to make sure the solution does exist. I have that freedom to choose whatever f I like. So what is the condition for this to have a solution, for t prime to exist? There's actually only one condition locally for these two equations to have a solution. Do you know what it is?
Yeah. Well, you can just divide the two by each other.
Or no.
Just differentiate so when you're differentiating to t, you can differentiate that one to r.
That's right. Okay.
And then
so the necessary, and I'm not going to prove it, but the necessary and sufficient condition for a solution is that it's obviously necessary, if there is a solution, that if I differentiate this with respect to R and this with respect to T, they better be equal, because partial derivatives commute. Okay, so necessary, and I'll put and sufficient. I'm not going to prove it. I won't prove that dt prime dr dt is dt prime dt dr, i.e. dr of fc equals dt of fd. And so what is this equation? So this is a first order partial differential equation for the unknown function f of R and T, and arbitrary thus far. Function f of R and T. And it's not difficult to see there always exists a solution of this equation, at least in a Taylor series. You see, given f of 0 and R, okay, let's imagine so think of this as an evolution equation, that I know f on some time slice, say t equals 0, and I want to determine f to the future of or the past of that time slice. Well, this equation is going to tell me the first derivative of f, right? So I plug in my f at t equals 0. This will give me the derivative of f at t equals 0. So now I'm going, because the Taylor series will give me f equals derivative times t, right, where t is small. And then differentiate this equation with respect to t. And now I get the second derivative of f in terms of the first derivative of f, which I already know. And you can just keep going. And you can get all the derivatives of f along at t equals 0. So this equation, dagger, gives you dtf at 0 and r. I've not been consistent about the order of the arguments. Let me call this always f of t and r. Dtf of 0 and r. And dt of dagger gives you dt squared f of 0 and r, etc. And then all you do is write down that f of t and r equals f of 0 and r plus t times dt f of 0 and r plus t squared over 2 dt squared f of 0 and r, etc. Okay, and of course, what I mean by expressions like this is I differentiate f and then set t equals 0, right? It's the derivative of f at t equals 0, likewise here.
Mm-hmm. So you have a Taylor expansion, but
yes.
Can you prove something nice about its convergence?
Yeah, Taylor expansions always converge within a small neighborhood.
Yeah, but the small
for smooth functions.
Could be general.
That's good enough for me.
With what?
Yeah.
A Taylor expansion, which is valid in a point?
Generically, they work. That's all I need.
Okay.
I'm not a mathematician. As long as all derivatives are bounded, Taylor series converge in a finite radius of convergence, actually. So they
the series of the things converge.
Taylor series always have good convergence properties. As long as all derivatives are finite, they will converge in a finite radius of convergence. Look up the math book.
If my Taylor coefficients are,
let's not argue about it. Let's not argue about Taylor series, please. Okay. So Taylor series are really, really good things. Let's see. So after these simplifications, we have found a function f which does solve these equations. Okay. Having found f, you can now, by the way, with some arbitrariness, because this function is still arbitrary in our solution for f, we could pick anything and it would satisfy this. And now we can find t prime by solving those equations. And so we have the metric in the form that we want. And now once again, I'm going to drop the prime and replace these arbitrary functions by some new arbitrary functions. So we will drop the prime and replace arbitrary functions by new arbitrary functions. And so we have the metric in the form minus dt prime squared, minus dt prime squared times a of t and r, and then we have plus b of t and r dr squared, and then I have r squared d omega squared. Okay, so I've removed two of the four arbitrary functions. Now we just have two arbitrary functions. Okay, so that's a very big simplification that any spherically symmetric metric can be put in this form.
The prime.
Sorry? Oh, sorry, thank you. No prime. Yeah. Okay, so now we can use the Einstein equations. And I've worked them out above. Okay, so use Einstein equations, R mu equals zero. So let's there they are, beautiful as they are. So there are more elegant ways of doing the solution involving using differential forms and so on, but that would take us too far astray from the course. And in any case, it's nice exercise to do this once. Well, if not nice, then instructive, let's put it that way. So what the definitions here are that dot implies d by dt, and prime implies d by dr. Okay. Obviously, the Christoffel symbols involve first derivatives of the metric, so I can get a dot, a prime, b dot, b prime. I have that r squared over there, so when I differentiate with respect to r, I'm going to get r's. I've got inverse metrics. Okay, so we need the inverse metric to get the Christoffel symbol. Now that's easy to write down because the metric is diagonal. So we have g mu nu in these coordinates is equal to minus a b r squared r squared sine squared theta, right? That's what the metric is, and the inverse metric is easy to get because I just invert all these coefficients. B inverse r to the minus 2, and then 1 over r squared sine squared theta. And so when you know the metric and the inverse metric, it's easy to calculate the Christoffel symbols, and that's what you get. And then you substitute those into our formula for the Riemann tensor and contract two of the indices, and you get the Ricci tensor. Okay. So these are in the notes, and I think they're correct. So we have these five differential equations. Let me just emphasize the only non-zero components, non-zero Christoffels and R's, and R mu's R. So the only non-zero components are these. Everything else is zero. And so we end up with five equations for two functions. Five equations for two functions, A and B. And so A and B look like they're very overdetermined. And indeed they are. It turns out we will show they have a unique solution up to a single constant. And when I say unique, it's unique up to coordinate transformations. Okay, so it's sort of a unique physical solution up to coordinate transformations. So this is the first example of a no-hair theorem that that the solutions of GR, the nonlinear solutions of GR, are actually very minimal in form. Now, what is the simplest equation of these five to solve? Which is the most surprising of these equations, and which can you solve immediately? What's that?
The last one.
Well, not really, because this is a differential equation involving A and B. Not sure how to solve it.
And the one below it.
Well, that's not even an equation at all, right? That's just saying this component is the same as that component. Okay. I want to solve for A and B. What's the easiest equation to solve? Number two looks pretty good. All right, so let's start with two. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Sorry, I said five equations. It should be four equations, because this one is just the same as the other one. So really only four equations for two functions. Let's start with two. And what's the solution of two? B dot is zero,
yeah.
Right? So d by dt of b and t and r equals zero. What's the solution of that equation?
A function of
B is a function of R. Okay. So so 2 implies B dot is 0, i.e. B equals B of R alone. There's no time dependence in B. Okay, so we're halfway there. If B dot is zero, notice that a lot of terms disappear, right? If B dot is zero, all of these guys are zero. Okay, so that's a big help. And now we just have equations in R. But we should still keep in mind that A might depend on T, right? A can still depend on T. We haven't got any equation that A dot is zero. So A can still be a function of R and T. But now we want to solve we want to relate B to A. So the way to do that is to look a little bit more carefully at these two equations, TT and RR. And how can I combine these to eliminate the second derivatives? Okay, so let's take 1 times well, just 1 plus 3 times A over B, right? A over B. So these two terms will cancel. This one and this one will cancel. And let's see what will.
The fourth one, the third equation with the second one.
Sorry?
Is it the fourth one in the first equation with the second one in the third?
OK, I'm doing this one and this one to cancel the second derivatives. This one doesn't involve any second derivatives.
The fourth term.
The term in the first equation.
Yes.
A prime squared divided by 4ab.
Yes.
One drops out. But
yes.
The second term.
Yes.
Yeah.
OK, so this drops out. And I think this term also drops out.
Yes.
Right? So this one and this one cancels. Okay. What? I'm not writing nasty symbols. I'm not writing nasty symbols. You've got evil minds. So let's combine those two equations. We've got A prime over B, R, plus B prime over A, R, right? From here, multiplying by, wait a second. No, I didn't get that right. B prime A over B squared, R. Equals zero. So that's a nice simple equation, because providing R is non-zero and B is non-zero, and it has to be non-zero because otherwise the determinant would vanish, I have B A prime plus A B prime equals zero, and that's equal to, so that means that A B prime equals zero. And so AB, so A is a constant over B. Actually, be careful. If the prime of something is zero, it just means it's a function of time. Okay? So the general solution is that A is a function of time over B with F arbitrary. And so now let's solve that. Whoops. Now, if we go back and look at the line element, if A is a function of time over B, it makes sense to redefine the time. Okay, so redefine t via dt prime squared equals f of t dt squared. And drop the prime. OK, so you can always do this. F has to be positive because the eigenvalues of the determinant have to be 3 positive, 1 negative. So F has to be positive. And I can take the square root of this equation. OK, and so this just means t prime is integral root f of t dt up to t. And we're just going to drop the prime. And so now we have a metric which is minus dt squared over b plus b dr squared plus r squared the omega squared. So that's why I emphasized it was unique up to coordinate transformations.
And now we do have a static thing, right?
Now, what's that?
Now we do have static.
Now we do have static, exactly. Excuse me. OK, so that's static, because we already proved b dot, well, equation 2 said b dot was 0. Now we have one more equation to use, equation 4. And so if A is 1 over B, or even if it was F of T over B, this equation determines B, OK? Because A prime over A is obviously minus B prime over B if A is 1 over B. A proportional to 1 over b implies this equation. And so now we have a single differential equation for b. So r theta equals 0 implies 1 minus 1 over b plus r b prime over b squared equals 0. And this is just r over b prime equals 1. OK, because if I differentiate this, I get 1 over b from differentiating to the r. And then I get minus b prime over b squared times r. And I take those over to the other side. I'll get exactly this equation. And so r over b is equal to r plus a constant. And this is the unique constant in the Schwarzschild metric. And so B is equal to 1 over 1 plus K over R. And of course, A is 1 over B, 1. So it's just 1 plus K over R. OK, and this is the Schwarzschild metric. OK, so that is Birkhoff's theorem. And the way we define that constant k is by the comparison with linear theory. So in linear theory, you will remember that A was basically 1 plus 2 phi over c squared, where phi is the Newtonian potential. And that agrees very nicely, because phi, Newtonian potential, goes like 1 over r. OK, so from linear recall, the Newtonian limit For h mu nu much less than 1, we had ds squared is minus 1 plus 2 phi dt squared, or it included this term, and phi over c squared. And so what we see is that k is minus 2 gm over c squared, where m is the Newtonian mass. OK, so the Schwarzschild metric is usually written in this form. Usually with this interpretation of the constant as ds squared equals minus 1 minus rs over r dt squared plus 1 over 1 minus rs over r dr squared plus r squared d omega squared, where rs equals the Schwarzschild radius is 2gm over c squared. And m is the mass. OK, so the metric is an exact solution of the empty space Einstein equations. And so if, for example, you take a star of mass m and you solve the equations exterior to the star, then as long if gravity is weak on the surface of the star, you can calculate the Newtonian potential just as in the Newtonian description is valid. And so the exterior metric is exactly this. If this mass m is condensed, all right, so if the star has a radius r, if r falls within rs, then you have to deal with this metric. So if a star collapses inside the Schwarzschild radius, let's say it the following. If the star becomes close rs, so let's say bigger than rs, the deviations from Newton become very large as you approach rs, right? Obviously, these terms are blowing up. But the exact description in general relativity is this one. If the star falls inside its Schwarzschild radius, you have an apparent problem because this metric passes through infinity. Okay, this guy blows up when the star falls inside its Schwarzschild radius. And it took, let's see, about over 30 years after Einstein discovered his equations for people to make sense of what was going on when that happens. When a star falls inside RS and the metric looks singular, it wasn't totally clear what happened. And then in around 1960, Martin Kruskal resolved that problem by showing that that was just an artifact of these coordinates. These Schwarzschild coordinates, even though they're very convenient, happen to have a coordinate singularity at r equals rs. So by changing coordinates, you can remove that singularity. And that's what we will do next time. So let me, I have some more time. So I can do, we won't do that this lecture. So we have this metric, which solves the Einstein equations. It Yeah, so let me just end by saying this represents a black hole of mass M. So if I take this metric to be valid everywhere, and there's really no matter involved anywhere in space-time, then this is a pure black hole with mass M. And that's the definition of the mass, is it's the parameter that enters in the Schwarzschild metric. So at large distances, the metric the black hole has looks like the metric of a star of mass M in the Newtonian approximation. I can go up. So by the way, you may be, I've told you about the LIGO experiment, which saw these two black holes merging and emitting gravitational waves. Something equally exciting is something called the Event Horizon Telescope. Which Avery Broderick here at Perimeter is one of the leaders of that project. And this project is to image the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Okay, there's a giant black hole in our own galaxy. So at the center of the Milky Way, called Sagittarius A, this object, is a giant black hole of mass M equal to 4 times 10 to the 6 solar masses, 4 million solar masses. It's not the biggest one we know of. In another galaxy, there appears to be a black hole of 10 billion solar masses. So very big black holes do seem to exist in the universe. This object has a Schwarzschild radius. The Schwarzschild radius is about 10 to the 10 meters. Okay, so in other words, 10 million kilometers, 10 to the 7 kilometers. It sounds big, but it's a long way away. Okay, so it's rather a small object because on the sky because it's so far away. The distance from us is about 2 times 10 to the 20 meters. That's at a distance of something like 30 kiloparsecs away from us. That's the distance from us to the center of our galaxy. And so the angle, this guy is sub 10. So here's the black hole. Here we are on Earth. We're looking at it. The angle it represents is twice the Schwarzschild radius over the distance. And so theta, the angle it subtends, turns out to be 10 to the minus 10 radians Okay, so radian means 360 degrees is 2 pi radians. The angle this obtains is 10 to the minus 10. It sounds ridiculously small, but it's actually just at the limit of what can be measured. So just at the limit, at the limiting resolution of a telescope which is the size of the Earth. Okay, because you know if I take a telescope whose aperture is d, then the angular resolution is approximately the wavelength divided by d, the wavelength of the waves you're using. And if you substitute in the size of the Earth, about 10,000 kilometers, the wavelength of radio waves, 10 to the fourth kilometers, this is frequency of radio waves. This is just sufficient. So it's just sufficient to resolve this angular radius. And right now, people are preparing images of the black hole in the center of the Milky Way using radio interferometry using the entire size of the planet. So they use all the radio telescopes on Earth in combination. They all stare at the center, they gather data, they construct the interference pattern, and they have preliminary indications of a blackening. So basically what they see is something like this. There's gas which is accreting around the black hole, and what they're looking for is a darkening effect in the center of that cloud of gas. They have preliminary evidence at about 3 sigma that it's there. And over the next 3 to 5 years, this is probably going to become overwhelming evidence that really is a black hole. And what they want to do is detect its spin to see if it is non-spherical and study the details of the motion of the gas in the metric of the black hole. So that's a really very exciting development, which parallels the LIGO discovery. As I mentioned, there are even bigger black holes in nearby galaxies. And it turns out that this 10 billion solar mass black hole is also around this limit of observability. It's further away, but it's bigger. And so we will also have observational data telling us, confirming the details of Einstein's theory, or finding some deviation. Okay, so let's now study what happens with this black hole. If you ask the obvious question, what's the obvious question? There's this mysterious object in the middle of our galaxy. What's the most obvious question to ask? Well, I want a bit more obvious than that. What's inside it is, yeah, how are you going to find out what's inside?
Jump in.
That's the question. What happens if I jump into a black hole? Okay, so we're very tempted. There's this guy there. Gravity is so strong that light cannot escape. We'll see that in a moment.
So this metric is an exact solution?
Yes.
Even though we... Because we found k by comparing to a...
Yeah, so k is a constant. The exact solution fixes k to be a constant. Okay. Now, you're free to label that constant how you like. And we label that constant to be 2gm, minus 2gm over c squared. That's the definition of m. So you can just think of that as naming k, something which makes it sound a bit more familiar. And that's what we mean by the mass of the black hole. So there is one parameter in the solution, and we're going to call it m, where m is the mass of the black hole. The reason for doing that is that if I'm at large distances from the black hole, the distortion of a metric is small, right? Because it goes like 1 over r. Mm-hmm. These terms go like 1 over r. And so at large distances, this looks just like the Newtonian gravitational potential of a star of mass m.
So this mass is just a Newtonian mass. It's not a new parameter.
The mass is a new parameter. It's defined by k.
It's defined by k, but if you just walk away very far, mm-hmm. then you already know what's going to happen, namely Newton.
Yeah, exactly. That's how Einstein built his theory,
yeah,
is to correspond to Newton.
It's not a new parameter. Because, like, I mean, you're comparing two constants, and if you walk away very far...
Yeah, no, I mean, I emphasized this when we derived the Einstein equations, that the amazing thing about Einstein's theory, he invented a whole new theory and didn't have to introduce any free parameters. Right? I don't think anybody has done anything like that since. He did. There was Newton's gravitational constant before. There was the concept of a mass before. He didn't do anything. He just said, you know, the theory is different. So yes, you can talk about m as the Newtonian mass, if you like. It really is an exact constant. Its interpretation is not Newtonian when you get near to the Schwarzschild radius. It's definitely not Newtonian. And in particular, things go bizarre, right? When r goes near rs, that coefficient of dr squared gets very big, and so something's going wrong. Einstein actually thought maybe the theory failed at that point at rs. Maybe his own theory failed, so he was wrong. It didn't fail. You can go inside RS by doing a coordinate transformation. But what you notice is that if I go to R less than RS, R is now a time-like variable because the coefficient of the metric is negative. So if you go inside this black hole at small r, actually R is the time. Okay, it's not, T is not the time because the coefficient of the dt squared term also changes sign. So t is actually a radial variable inside the black hole, and r is the time. Okay, and the direction, so in relativity, you have no choice but to travel to the future, right? We can't go back in time. And that is ensured by the light cone structure of special relativity, that the only motion possible is motion within the future light cone. Right? If we follow a particle, it has no option. It cannot go faster than the speed of light, and so it has to stay inside this light cone. Inside the black hole, this means you cannot do any. You cannot avoid going to smaller r. Going to decreasing r is increasing time. You have no option but to go to smaller r. You've got no option except to go to r equals zero. Okay. And when you go to r equals 0, well, then the metric is infinity again. R equals 0, those coefficients blow up. And this time, that's a real singularity. You cannot remove it with a coordinate transformation. So hitting r equals 0 is the end of gr. The Riemann curvature is infinite. And there are scalar invariants which are infinite. So basically, you fall inside a black hole, r becomes the time, and you head towards r equals 0, and that's the end of you. Or at least it's the end of the theory. And so it's kind of interesting to ask, if I fall inside a black hole, how long do I have? Okay? R is the time. I inevitably am going to fall from r equals rs to r equals 0. I only have a finite duration of time, and we can easily calculate what it is. And it turns out it depends on the mass of the black hole. Yeah, roughly speaking, the time you have, the survival time, if you fall inside the Schwarzschild radius, is just rs over the speed of light. I mean, that's obviously the naive guess. And this is correct. It happens to be a factor of pi over 2, but it doesn't really change things much. And it turns out that this is 10 to the minus 5. Rs is proportional to m. Rs is 2gm over c squared. So this is 10 to the minus 5, the mass over the mass of the sun in seconds. So if the black hole is a one solar mass black hole, you have one, you've got 10 millionths of a second before you're crushed. If it's a million solar masses, you've got 4 million, you know, the one in our center of our galaxy, 4 million solar masses, you've got 40 seconds. So you fall into the Schwarzschild radius, and then you've got 40 seconds before you hit R equals zero. So
that's in the frame of the black hole.
That is in your own frame. That is the proper time. The proper time. I should actually call it tau. Proper time. Okay. I'll do the derivation next time because it'll take a few minutes. Are there any questions?
Mm-hmm. Since the solution is exact, why don't we see like gravitational wave solutions outside of the vacuum?
So the assumption of spherical symmetry removes gravitational waves. There are no spherically symmetric gravitational waves in GR. And that follows from the fact that they, let me see if this should be obvious. We saw that gravitational waves are only emitted by objects with a quadrupole, right? So certainly nothing which pulses radially will emit gravitational waves. Even if it has a dipole, it won't emit gravitational waves. It's only have a quadrupole. There are no. So spherical symmetry eliminated the gravitational waves. In reality, black holes will not be spherically symmetric. This is a simplifying assumption, but it's not true in nature, because what happens is when a star collapses, in general, that star has some angular momentum, and then this metric is wrong. So if you leave spherical symmetry, the most general solution of the Einstein equations is still rather unique, but it has an extra parameter, which is the angular momentum. And that is called the Kerr metric, discovered by Kerr in 1960-something. It was an amazing discovery. The Schwarzschild one you can almost understand intuitively, but the Kerr metric, I mean, it really took mathematical genius to guess the answer and check the equations. It's a much more messy and complicated metric. And the interior structure is much more complicated as well. It has a sort of ring in the middle of it, and there's the possibility of closed time-like curves and all kinds of really bizarre phenomena inside the Kerr black hole. But we won't have time to talk about that.
Time-like curve?
Yeah. So it's very, very interesting in the Kerr black hole. Yeah.
In order to derive the Schwarzschild coordinates, we took a lot of liberties with like free functions and whatnot. So how can we give a physical meaning to the coordinates where we write down the final nice form of the Schwarzschild metric?
Sorry? How can we give a physical meaning to the
coordinates in the Schwarzschild metric?
They are where they are. They're just a coordinate system, which is convenient.
Okay.
But you should never, as I said many times, never take any one coordinate system very seriously, because you always have this ambiguity. And so you need to calculate something. So whenever you calculate a physical quantity, like the result of an experiment, that quantity has to be independent of whatever coordinate system you choose. Okay? And so, unfortunately, our minds are not very good at dealing with geometry. And the only way we have is through algebra. And algebra is not really a great way to describe geometry. It involves introducing coordinates. And that's, we know they don't mean anything. Yeah?
So the fact that the metric is degenerate for phi dipole to zero,
Is that also because of the Gordon's region?
Yes, it is, exactly. So that is a completely normal coordinate singularity. So, you know, if I take a sphere in flat space, R3, right? So if we picture a sphere in flat space, three dimensions, there's an S2. There's a sort of non-singular definition of the sphere, which is x squared equals 1. Right? So R3 is a completely good metric. The metric here is just delta ij. This is a completely non-singular definition of a sphere in R3. Right? It treats all points the same. They should be all the same. And that's the metric. But if you want to describe things intrinsically, if you want to describe the geometry of the sphere, what you do is you take the metric from flat space, which is just the Euclidean metric, and you impose this restriction. Okay? And then I just work out what this is. So here, the way of solving this equation would be to introduce the formulae I wrote down, x, y, z equals whatever, sine theta cos phi. And then the Euclidean metric on flat space becomes, I'm going from three coordinates to two, this becomes the d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And then, as you said, this is degenerate at theta equals zero. And what's going on? Well, it's not hard to see the problem. If you draw the lines of constant coordinate, lines of constant theta, you know, do this. So these lines are theta equals constant. And lines of constant phi do that. Sorry, they all meet. These are phi equals constant. And then if I go to the north pole or the south pole, you know, what I get is this. And so the north pole has many values of phi. Doesn't have a unique value. So the north pole means theta equals zero and phi arbitrary. So there is not a one-to-one map from the space to the coordinates. And that's a classic coordinate singularity. Coordinate. And the same for the south pole. So you have to keep in mind, if you use spherical polars, that the coordinates are really bad at those two points. How do you avoid it? Well, there's another way of you can partially avoid it by going to projective coordinates. Right? So what I do is consider a plane, and then I take the north pole, I take some point P, I want its coordinates, and I just draw the line from the north pole through P to a point on the plane. It hits the plane at some point. And so in this way, for every point on the sphere, I associate a point on the plane. And you can work out what they are, and you can work out the metric. In fact, I think it's in the notes even, that example. And then you discover, I mean, fairly obviously, these coordinates are not, it's in one of these sections. I didn't have time to describe it. Let me see.
Neil?
Yeah.
Why would you, this doesn't really solve anything. Like,
it's still,
the North Pole is mapped to infinity.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't have a face again, so you just have one singular.
No, only have one singular. This one you have two. Exactly. Yeah, so it's an improvement. So the North Pole coordinates are non-singular at the South Pole, right? Because obviously the lower half of the sphere is mapped to the interior of this disk, and that is completely non-singular. So the nice thing about the projective coordinates is you have two patches North Pole or South Pole coordinates, which each are almost complete but miss one point. Okay? And so the way you deal with this is, in general, if I have a manifold, you will need multiple coordinate patches to cover it. And in the case of the sphere, you need at least two. You cannot cover the whole sphere with one coordinate patch in a non-singular way. Okay, so there are theorems to that effect. The minimum number of patches you need depends on the topology of the space. And because the sphere has a non-trivial topology, that is an obstruction to mapping it into flat space, which has a trivial topology. So what you have to show is that you can cover the space with several coordinate patches. And then in between these patches, there are, of course, the transition functions, which are these Jacobian matrices. And in general, one has to show, let's say I have multiple patches, you have to show that the whole description is compatible. In other words, if I change from this coordinates, from the South Pole coordinates to the North Pole coordinates, and in more complicated manifolds to some other coordinates, I have to show that I always get the same results. So if I go from x to x prime, or from x to x double prime to x prime, I have to show that everything is consistent. I haven't done that, but that's exactly what Riemann did. So for example, when you construct the connection, you know, the connection has this very complicated transformation law with involving second derivatives of the coordinate transformation. You have to show that is all consistent between any three patches. You have to show that this diagram commutes. If I go from x to x prime, it's the same as going from x to x double prime to x prime, and so on. So there's a whole mathematics associated with showing that it's consistent to describe geometry with multiple coordinate patches. And in general, you have no option. You have to have multiple coordinate patches for reasons of topology. Okay, the alternative is to have sort of redundant coordinates, like in here I'm using three coordinates to describe a two-dimensional surface. Then I can do it in a non-singular way as well. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so see you tomorrow.